I would like to introduce our first speaker. From Kazakhstan, this topic will be not been changed.
Hi, family. My name is Regan. I'm an addict. Wow. The first one of these early meetings on Friday, what I'm used to is a nice, small, intimate group, and I come here and it's a big ballroom. Wow. You know, when Dini asked me to share, that was not part of the plan. But I'm here because, when somebody in the NA asks you to do something, you know, I learned to take suggestions early. Thank you. One of the suggestions was if somebody asks you to do something in the program to help carry the message, that's what you do, because that's why we're here, to carry the message to the addict who still suffers. And just being here, looking at all the people in the room, it helps me. And I know, I really believe, just based on my experience, that being in the room with others who are suffering on the same path, on that same journey of recovery, I think it helps. So there's a few things that I wanted to share about this topic, and I first want to say that it is only through the therapeutic value of addicts like the people in this room helping me that I have been able, and I think, you know, when I first came in, I underestimated the therapeutic value of one addict helping another. I mean, I knew this was a self-help program, but, you know, I was living under this understanding that I could figure it out. I could work it out. And I had no idea the power of this addiction. And I didn't realize that I really needed addicts all over the world, because wherever I go, this disease goes with me. And by myself, I will use. But the therapeutic value, you know, like when I was in the Bahamas, being able to find a meeting there, or if you're in another city, being able to find a meeting there, that makes a difference. So we're engaged in this journey of recovery. At least I hope everybody is. I certainly want to be. So before I get started, you know, you're supposed to share your experience, strength, and hope. So let me just qualify myself quickly. 1970, at the age of 14, I began my practice. I realize there's going to be some disturbances here because I guess they're setting up, so hopefully people can hear. But I began the practice of active addiction. It was really just stealing little drinks of beer and little extra hot toddy after I was sick and my mom introduced me to a hot toddy. I don't know if y'all know what that is, where you pour some alcohol in with some sugar and little kids, you know, you feel warm inside. That was magic. And I felt like I needed more hot toddies. I would get sick, or fake being sick, to get those things. Anyway, from the age of 14, I only practiced on an infrequent basis until I was introduced to Mary Jane. And the first time, it didn't work for me, but I kept trying, and it finally worked. It did its magic, and from the age of 16 till the age of 32, I did not stop. I don't need to give you all the details if you know, you've been on this journey to get you to this journey, you know, that journey before this one. And like, the only time I remember stopping, because see, shortly after Mary Jane came, then that little white powder started popping up into my face, and then other things happened. You know, you sell drugs and all that stuff goes on. But the only time I ever remember stopping was I decided to sign up for Army ROTC. I don't know why. And I went out to Fort Knox, Kentucky, and I got there, and I realized since I'm going on this Army base, I needed to clean up. So I got rid of what I had. I was blitzed before I went in there. And then basic training started. And if anybody's been in the service, you know they don't play. And so for those first 2 weeks, I couldn't use. And for an addict, you know, someone who's been using every day and you can't use, it's confusion. And I'm with a bunch of other crazy people, I learned, who were also addicts who had just stopped using. And we are running around with guns. So that was quite an experience. And then I could barely get through those 2 weeks, to be honest with you. If it wasn't for the regimentation, you know, waking you up at 0:30 and doing the run and PT and feeding you more than you needed to eat and running around in the dark and the rain at night, if it wasn't for them keeping me busy, I don't know if I would have made it. But at 2 weeks, they give you this little thing. They say, you can go and leave. Louisville, Kentucky. Stayed there for, I don't know, I guess we were there for about a day and a half nonstop, and came back adequately supplied for the rest of the 6 weeks of basic training. And I never stopped until the age of 32. So my journey that got me to this journey ended on July 10th, 1988. It's emotional for me because, you know, I don't think anybody who's been around will ever forget how they got here and that last high. Because, you know, for years, man, I was chasing that thing that I had in the beginning, and it wasn't coming back. It didn't come back. It wasn't like that anymore. But on July 10th, I walked into my third 12-step meeting, because the first two times it didn't quite stick. Just to give you an example of my insanity, and that's part of this topic of if nothing changes, nothing changes. And that's insanity, because I didn't change. I worked as a nurse. I worked in the hospital. I took care of people who were sick. They gave me the keys to the narcotics cabinet. And I don't think I've ever admitted this to this larger group, but in addition to doing the unspeakable, which is coming to work high, which you should never do when you're entrusted to care for the lives of people, and I swear I probably made some mistakes, because sometimes you have to, like, make quick decisions, you know? But I do remember a cancer patient that I was taking care of, and he was prescribed a certain type of narcotic that I liked. And even though I didn't ask his permission, I felt it was appropriate that we share. Yeah. And so, you know, there's a way to have him, you know, have it be perceived that he's being administered this drug every 2 hours, when actually he's only getting it every 4 hours. We're splitting it. We went in half. And so, you know, to steal narcotics from a dying cancer patient is low. But that's what this disease will do. It will convince me that it's okay to do the unspeakable. So I can say it's the disease, but I did it. So when I say nothing changes, nothing changes. I worked in alcohol rehab. I was treating the drunks and then get in my car and get drunk and go home and get high and then be too high to get back to work. But anyway, enough of the drug law. Bottom line is, I got into this journey. I got into this journey because it was no longer acceptable for me to live that way. You know, when you know you're stealing from people, lying to people, and hurting yourself, and know for damn sure you're getting ready to end up dead as a part of the process, if I didn't go to jail or hit an institution, because my path was straight to jail. Straight to death. I knew how to avoid jail. I could talk my way out of an institution because I worked in them long enough. And so I only had one option, and I saw a glimpse of that before I decided to come into the program. And so what happened was stuff started to change. My sponsor, for many years until he passed, was Harold J. And Harold's favorite saying And one of the reasons why I think Dini asked me to speak on this topic, I don't know if you knew this, but I think you did. Harold would always say, you know, when you're working and trying to work the steps or you're trying to work an issue, whatever, and you just wouldn't do what you're supposed to do, you know exactly what you're supposed to do, but you don't want to. I've been there. Maybe no one else has, but I've been there. Harold would just look at me. He'd say, if nothing changes, nothing changes. First few times I heard that, it was just annoying. You know, like he was trying to apply that to me. He was trying to send me a message. And then after a while, I realized other people would act up. And Harold would say, if nothing changes, nothing changes. And you know, these cliches have very deep, very profound meaning once you uncover that meaning in your life. And for me, what I realized was that I could not stop using without the help of this program, the people in the program, God of my understanding, the literature, step work, a sponsor, and continuing to come to meetings. When I did that, the first thing that changed was I stopped using. Now, for many years and for many people, that's good. That's enough. But that's the first step. That's the prerequisite. So let me just tell you what, you know, my real life is, what's going on now. So I've been clean, thank God, I don't know how, but I've been clean 24 years. Thank you. And I thank God, and I thank this program, because I have had 24 years times 365 days, that's how many opportunities I've had to go back out. You know, the longer you stay in, the closer you are to getting high. That didn't make sense to me either for a while. But if I haven't been using for 24 years and I can use tomorrow, I'm definitely closer to using. So anyway, my real life thing today is this. I'm married my second time, because I got married when I was high the first time. Okay, and I don't know about you, but you know, you come down and you see this ring on your finger and people are saying congratulations and you're like, what, you know, what was that all about? And so this woman, crazy woman, was living with me. And I asked her to come with me. And so we ended up getting a divorce after we had a son. And as a direct result of my addiction, not only are we not married, but for many years my son wouldn't speak to me. I spent a lot of money in court. I spent, you know, countless hours on the couch of a psychiatrist crying. Police had to pull me in when I tried to scale the walls and get in the back, and when I kicked the door in and all that crazy stuff. But now I'm married and I have a 12-year-old daughter. I'm trying to live life on life's terms now. And the difference back then was I lied, I ran, I used rationalization, I used denial, I got high. I did whatever I had to do to not feel what I didn't want to feel. And nothing changed. Nothing changed. Now that I'm not using and I've been practicing these principles, I've gone to school and got another piece of education. I own a house. I've been married, if I don't mess up, in the May, 20 years. I'm trying not to mess up. And I have a daughter in this new marriage, and I did it differently. She loves me. She talks to me. She relies on me. When she gets hurt, where's Daddy? You know? So what's different for me is responsibility. Responsibility is a big word. I was irresponsible when I was using. I'm responsible now. Responsibility is like the biggest change that I have ever encountered. Because it means that when something is hurting, when I have a feeling that I like to run from, I can't. I mean, I could choose to, but I wouldn't be responsible. So what I have to do is, you know, you remember face everything and recover, and then there was F everything and run. I was on that side before. Now I'm on this side. So I learned that my daughter has this version of autism that's called Asperger's. We learned this years ago. And so we've had to do a lot, man, you know, for my daughter. We've had to, you know, take her to therapists. We've had to have her assessed. We had to relocate from Maryland to Virginia to a special school that deals with children who have my daughter's condition. She's brilliant. She's much smarter than I am, but she's very socially awkward. And I've had to be there for her. And there's days when I'm thinking, man, this is tough. I don't really want to do this. Or, you know, maybe my wife could do this without me if I wasn't here and I could go have fun. But that's not being responsible. And then my wife, you know, I kind of knew she was nervous about things. And then one day she confides in me that she has panic disorder. So she can't drive on highways. So that means more responsibility for me. I got to drive her places and, you know, got to stay away from bridges and things like that. And it's a condition, she's getting treated for it, but I got to step up. There's more things I have to do. I don't want to some days, but the truth is, the other thing that changed for me is I learned this thing called love and unconditional positive regard. And caring for somebody, sharing what I have, all that's part of responsibility. And so I'm dealing with life, you know. I'm doing those things that some people think men don't want to do. Like, I do the laundry, I wash the dishes, I cook, because my wife spends a lot of time taking my daughter to therapy, to treatment, to school. So she's been responsible in many ways for caring for my daughter, so I got to pick up the slack. So then my most recent pain, which I just get it out. So March 22nd, my father died. My father was 90 years old, and he lived a good life. And I knew that I was going to end up in here talking about this, and I might cry, because I have not cried yet. And I took off from work, and he's in North Carolina. I went down there. Where's my five-minute warning? Who's my five-minute warning? Okay, don't worry about it. All right. So I took off from work. My father had Alzheimer's. And I don't know if you know what it's like when you go to see somebody and you've lived with them your whole life, and they're not quite sure who you are. And you have children, and during the conversation, you know, my daughter was so good. It's like she didn't mind telling my dad over and over how old she was, what grade she was in, and where she lived. At that tender age, she learned to you know, be okay with that. And with Alzheimer's sometimes, or dementia, there's progression to where you can no longer speak. And you can't walk. And it got to that point. And then, you know, after being in and out of the hospital, it was time for him to go to a hospice. So I took off work and I went down to North Carolina. And I stayed with my mom every day. I took her to the hospice. I took her home. I worked with the nurses. I worked with the doctors. I worked with the chaplain. I was the executor for my father's will. And he wanted to be cremated, and he wanted no extenuating, you know, no life-sustaining stuff. He didn't want any ventilator. He didn't want any tube. So we had to go in every day knowing that he was not eating and he was going to waste away, and I had to watch that. And I had to be strong for my brother. I had to be strong for my mother. And you know what? We did what he wanted. He lived a good life. He wasn't in pain. Although I have to admit, he had a morphine pump. And every time I pushed that button on that morphine pump, the addiction said, "What about me? What about me?" But that was his morphine. We weren't going half on that one. So he's resting now. He taught me what it was like to be a man. He taught me about responsibility, and the program of Narcotics Anonymous allowed me to step into that. That was what changed. The door opened to reality, and it was okay. See, before, when the door opened to reality, I looked in and I saw reality. I said, I don't want any of that. Nope. Now, the truth is, there's nothing but reality. It's, you know, you can leave, you can go hide, you can get, it's still gonna be there. And that's what I learned. And that's why I just face it now. If you face it up front and deal with it, it doesn't hurt as much. You get it done faster, and you get a better outcome. And so the other saying that this kind of brings home for me is another one that, you know, many of you know very well, and I found it to be so true. And it has to do with faith versus fear. If you ever read the IP on the triangle of self-obsession, you know there's this and there's that. And there's fear on one side and there's faith on the other side. And what I learned only through experience is that fear and faith cannot occupy the same space at the same time. So, if I'm living in fear, you know, fight or flight, if something bad happens, I'm going to run or I'm going to pump up and I'm coming after you. Because I didn't want to hurt me, I want to hurt you. When something's wrong, something's scary, if I don't run, you know, we're going to strap up and do something wrong. But if you have faith, let me speak from my experience. When I trust in the power, higher power of my understanding, the program of Narcotics Anonymous, and the experiences that I've had, if I trust in that and I have faith in my God, and I know He won't give me anything that I can't get through, I will get through it. And then there's no fear. You know, like right now, my son, I told you about my son. He's 28 years old now from my first marriage. My son graduated from Harvard, undergraduate. He graduated from Mount Sinai Medical School. He's in a surgical residency in New York, finished his first year. And then as he was signing up to match up for his second year, there was a little administrative glitch, and they said, no, you can't do this. Not the way you want to do it. And so that kind of messed him up. And he went into a depressive downspin and kind of went missing. And so now, I found out my son was using crack. Going to Atlantic City gambling. He's in New York, and I'm not breaking his confidentiality because he's not in the program as much as I try. But he's still in this downspin. And it's painful for me because I know what it's like. And I've been trying. He won't, most of the time he won't answer a text. He won't answer a phone call. He was living out of his car, living with women, doing all that stuff that we do. And but when my father died, this little miracle happened. I had been trying to get him to see his grandfather, who he had not seen in 23 years. Last time he was like 5 or 6 years old, he went down to North Carolina on the farm and he saw them. He just shut us out. When my father died, the day before the funeral, my ex-wife called and said, he would like to come. Will you sponsor us? Now, I caught on to the us, okay, because I was thinking of him. But my current wife stepped up and said, what's the right thing to do? What's the next right thing? So I said, yes. I paid for them to fly down. My son, who my mother had not seen in 25 years, showed up at the funeral. First time my mother in 25 years had ever seen her grandson. While she's burying her husband, she's being reunited with her grandson. But I had to be responsible enough and face reality and do the right thing. Because I tell you, I wanted to explain the difference between me paying for both of y'all and me paying for him and why you don't need to. No, that didn't make any sense. So anyway, I'm going to close with fear and faith cannot occupy the same space at the same time. Nothing changes if nothing changes, but when nothing's changing, keep doing the same thing, and you will get the same results. I'm only speaking about me, but there is no limit of possibilities, no limit when you follow the principles of this program, take advice, have faith. I love my life today, and I'm going to keep doing what I need to do for my family, for my mother, for this program, and I hope that you all do the same. Thanks.
Thank you. Let's give him a hand again. Later. Okay, this time I'd like to introduce our second speaker. She's from D.C. And she's going to talk about my side of the street. And without any further ado, I'll give you the opening.
I'm an addict. My name is Delphine. I know it's only by God's grace that I'm here and clean and I'm fully dressed and somewhat in my right mind today. And I want to thank the program committee for asking me to participate in this. And I want to thank my co-workshop. Okay. for letting me go second. I had a lot of thoughts about my side of the street, and I sought input and got a lot of input about it. And one of the things I was told, and this is by my sponsor, is that my side of the street is all the work that I have to do to get to 12 to be able to carry this message and practice the principles in all of my affairs. And, you know, I don't quite know how to break it down like that, but I decided to just break it down with what's going on my side of the street. My clean date is November the 11th, 1987. And that would, thank you. That would feel good if I had used longer than that, but that's okay. I appreciate that. And I'm a member of the One Step at a Time group of NA in the DC area. And I'm coming up on 25 years of being a member there. And so that's done a lot to help shape me, you know, just stay in there, you know, on my side of the street and trying to, you know, participate in business meetings and so forth. But anyhow, moving right along, I've gotten so in the last couple of years that I've, in order to not feel overwhelmed, to feel like I had too much on my plate, I started separating it into different plates. So that I could tell myself I'm dealing with this plate today, I'm dealing with that plate, I just do what I can and move on to another plate. And my plates have been my health. I have an aunt that's 92 that I'm a caretaker for, and she lives in Camden, New Jersey, and I've had to commute back and forth doing that and getting her into hospice and so forth. I've been unemployed. I've been fighting foreclosure. And if I have time, I'll go into some of the other ones, some of the other issues. But about 4 years ago, matter of fact, beginning of May in 2009, I was leaving a meeting. I fell, bust my chin, re-injured my foot, and I had to go on short-term disability. So I could see right away that I wasn't going to be able to pay my mortgage with that, and so I tried to get some help. I tried to get I asked them to take 2 months and put it on the end of the loan, and they told me apply for a modification. And so I said, okay. And when I did that, come to find out I was ahead, and I didn't even know it because I was paying every 2 weeks, so I had to wait before I could apply again. And in the meantime, my security clearance lapsed, and when I went to get it renewed again, they said, well, you're 1 month behind on your mortgage. We can't give you your security clearance and let you go back to work. And that started a cycle, okay? And we'll come back to that cycle. But what I realized today, in hindsight, is that I didn't put the fear, I put the faith ahead of the fear. And I came up with a bright idea to help out in the meantime, and that was to sell fireworks at a fire stand. And fast forwarding on that, for the first time in my life at 60 years old, I got arrested, mugshot, fingerprinted, and taken to jail behind that, okay? And so I had that issue to deal with for months until I got, you know, out from under that and then cleared that away. And I realized today that I had forgotten, or maybe I didn't even know it at that point in time, and I know today that God is all I need. But then I was going to help out. You know, I had a bright idea. So I had that going on. I mentioned my aunt that I've been, you know, taking care of her, doing, you know, her paperwork, going back and forth to New Jersey, getting her affairs in order and so forth. And it came time when I had to apply to be guardian, have guardianship over her. And she didn't want me to have guardianship. She kept saying, no, no, no. And she told her lawyer, you know, no. She told the courts, everybody, no. And she kept saying that she wanted her nephew, the attorney from Pittsburgh, to be her guardian, handle the case. And we kept saying, she doesn't have a nephew that's an attorney in Pittsburgh. Why does she keep saying that? And come to realize that I have a brother who was in this commercial for the Steelers back in the 80s, where he played this attorney, and that's where her mind was, okay? And then when she finally, you know, when I finally got to go to court and I saw why she told her attorney that she didn't want me to do it, using my words, she said that I'm a dope fiend. That's why she didn't want me to handle her affairs. And I thought, oh my God, she put this on the state record for all time in New Jersey. I had to go to court anyhow. But I told him that for only by God's grace, the judge let me speak. And I said that, I explained to her about my brother who wasn't really a lawyer, and I said that I haven't been like that in more than 20 years, okay? And I guess the judge understood and granted me guardianship, no bond, no nothing. She just trusted me and turned it over. I guess she knew that there's something had changed, that her mind was actually stuck back there in the 80s. And I share that, I've mentioned that a lot of times because sometimes the harm, it never occurred to me that anybody's mind could get stuck on that harm, even though I'm years in the future and making amends and taking care and doing all that. And the saddest part about it is she doesn't know me anymore. She doesn't know anybody. But I still have to do the right thing because that's on my side of the street, and I've done the paperwork back and forth, faxing and filing and all that to get the Medicaid to help cover for that. I've done the paperwork back and forth for 3.5 years with the mortgage company. I've testified for city council and, you know, about all of that. And I'm proud to say on February 26th, they finally came around and were going to give me another chance with that. And it was just the only thing I could say that my part that I could have played in is that I didn't use. I think my attitude was the best. You know, I wasn't encouraging a lot. My faith might have shrunk a lot, but I didn't use. And I just kept persevering and going forth and faxing the next thing and refaxing and recopying and retaking the calls and just going on one foot ahead of the other, because that's what I have to do to stay here. And as my sponsors say, to get to carry the message. I've had up and down issues with my health as I grow old gracefully. And one of the things was the liver, and I was on treatment for that last year, and I thought I was going to die. my hairdresser was talking a couple months ago, and she was telling other people in the shop about how she couldn't believe the change from when I came in there over a year ago and asked her if she would do my hair for my funeral. she was just appalled at that. We think like that, but she was taken off about that. And one of her coworkers said something about me always singing, you know, because something would come on, an old song, something, I'd pick up with it. So that lets me know that people see us better than we see ourselves, and there's things in there that can come out from our side of the street if we let them, if I let them. And so that's what I try and do today. This past winter, I had a horrendous asthma attack that would not let go. Every other week, I was either in the emergency room, in the hospital, or at the doctor's, and that was why I asked if I could catch my breath before I went on. I just had so much trouble breathing, which totally changes the perspective on what's important when you can't grasp a breath. You know, when I take it for granted and it's not easy to do, or I wake up out of breath, then I started putting priorities and things in perspective. You know, I started looking at what's really important, you know. That's why I believe that doing the right thing and doing what I'm supposed to, practice these principles in all my affairs, is what's supposed to be done on my side of the street. And that's what I have to keep doing, keep forging ahead to do that. Like I said, I've been unemployed full time for more than 4 years, but I haven't been homeless or hungry or on the street or naked or... The God of my understanding has made a way in spite of me. And that's why I start off with the grace. It is God's grace, because it's nothing I've earned or done to do this. I was talking to someone, I think it was my sponsor, as a matter of fact, and I was saying I couldn't get over, I understand how I could surrender in November 87. I didn't intend to be a 100% surrender. It was only supposed to be a surrender for a year when I went in there. I had planned on taking my last drink on November the 11th, 1987. The bottle was empty, and I couldn't figure out why. I thought someone had stolen it. But I said I should be out of treatment in 2 weeks and know how to do this, and I'm not going to worry about it. I threw the bottle and my works away. I left the pipe hidden in the house because I was going to give up some things and be able to handle others. But I got in the treatment finally and learned that I had this disease of addiction, and there was no combination of people, places, or things that was ever going to help me. And I had to surrender to that. I called home and told them where the pipe was hidden and told them to get rid of it. But still, I was only going to do this for 1 year because I wanted to be one of those people with a year more. That's all I wanted out of this, just to be able to stand, you know, all those with a year more, up there they stand up. So I was, you know, looking forward to doing that. And I ended up getting stuck here that first year. I ended up getting addicted to people saying, keep coming back, and acting like they meant it. I was overwhelmed that folks, you know, said they wanted me to come back, and they sounded like it. I got addicted to knowing that it's morning, afternoon, or evening. You know, when I answer the phone, I usually say good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, because I love knowing that it's Friday afternoon. I'm not coming to and wondering, is it light because it's still the same day, or is it the next day that I forget to call in? Do I have to give them two lies, why I didn't call in and why I didn't come in too? And not having to live like that makes it easy to want to stay on this side of the street, okay? That's one of the things that help. I have contact with my family. I never would have imagined or guessed or dreamed that I could become a matriarch of a family. But I am the matriarch of mine, other than my aunt, who's 92. I'm the oldest person. And they asked me a couple months ago if we could have a family reunion in D.C. at my house. I said, yeah, sure, because I'm thinking maybe the bank will let me stay in here long enough to do that. But I didn't think that, you know, we'd be willing to. But I agreed to do it anyhow, and come to find out that I will be able to stay there. And it's such an honor and a blessing to do that, to be able to carry on and stand up, you know, and take a place. You know, my mother took me to my first meeting. I was 39 years old, and she, like my job here, called up and told her to find a place for me in Pittsburgh and get me in, and she took me to a meeting. And at that first meeting, I still remember my first meeting. They asked for anybody out of, from out of town or new or anything like that. My mother, was that you? That's you. Raise your hand. 5 minutes.
Okay, not
you. Oh, all right. Thank you. And I wouldn't do it because I didn't want you all to know my business. Not knowing that somebody there for the first time with your mother was obviously new, but, and you know, I got over that. But she became a real proponent of this program. She got into a related fellowship, which is very big up there, and I guess it's all right to say Naranon, and was very supportive with it. And I can remember when I picked up my first, when I picked up my 96-month key tag, and it was Mother's Day, and I showed it to her, and she said, oh, she was so proud. And she said I had more than made amends to her. And I thought, well, why would she think I needed to make amends to her? You know, I didn't understand, you know, why she said that. Because I looked at the steps, you know, I divided the steps up immediately. Some that I didn't have to work, some that I needed to work, and some I'd decide about later. And 8 and 9 were in the section that I didn't need to work, hadn't harmed nobody, nowhere, no how. And I'm, you know, here to say that it's the, it took 7 steps for me to get to the place where, yes, I did owe, I did, there was no doubt, no hesitation in my mind that I owed amends. And, you know, I found a postcard a couple of weeks ago, matter of fact, that I still have. I had a postcard up in my little office, and it's still there, and it's a picture of St. Thomas, and it's a postcard. My second year, my job, you know, I had to go to St. Thomas with my job, and it was on Mother's Day, and I was hesitant about telling her, and I said, I told her I wouldn't be home for Mother's Day because I had to go there, and I hesitated for a second. I asked if she wanted to go with me, and she said yes, she did, and I took her with me on the job, and she sent a postcard back to her job about it was Mother's Day, and she couldn't believe, you know, she was so proud, and it was more than her wildest dream, and I never even noticed that until a couple of weeks ago. I must have at some point when she passed noticed it enough to take it and save it. But to get in touch with that, you know, recently, and how I had come full circle with that, and giving it back and knowing that she'd be proud of me. And that while I rejected it and got so good at addiction for so many years, I was back around to the, I was on the other side of the street now, and able to take in some of those principles that they tried to teach me, but I wasn't open to the principles then. I was open to wanting to do what I wanted to do when I could do it, and think that I was having fun and all of that. I have one last example of what on my side of the street. A couple of months ago, somebody tracked me down on Facebook and sent a message to my cell phone and asked, was I the Delphine that knew their brother? And I said, who is your brother? And then, you know, we went back and forth for a while. I'm thinking we're texting, but they were actually going through, for however it worked, I don't know. But come to find out, I finally gave her my phone, and we talked, and her brother and I were really, really, really close. She said he's in a nursing home now. He has dementia. He doesn't know any too many people. He doesn't remember much, but he remembers 40 years ago and everything about me, and he keeps talking about me. So my first thought was, well, maybe he wants to make an amends to me since... I had started using with him. And then I remembered what my sponsor told me when I had people on the list, my siblings, for using with them. And she said that, no, that's not the reason why they should be on your list. They had a choice to use like you had a choice to use. And so I have to apply that same thing to me. I had a choice to use. I can't blame it on him. And so he doesn't owe me an amends for that. But as I talked to his sister more, she said that she remembered me because I had made such an impact on her and her family 40 years ago, and that her mother talked about me the rest of her life and tried to encourage him to, you know, do what he needed to do because I was a good person to have in his life. And then I remembered the last conversation I had with him. And he asked me, what was I going to do when I had to stop getting high? And I said, why would I have to stop getting high? Well, I didn't understand that, you know, back in the early 70s. No, that wasn't an issue. But then I realized that I had probably caused harm to him in dealing with his family. And now that's on me to straighten out from my side of the street, even though it's nothing that I thought of or did intentionally or knew all these years. God brought the opportunity to me, so now I have to do something about it. That's how I look at taking care of my side of the street. That even if I don't know that it's on my side, that when I do know or find out or think, as I trust in this process and trust in my higher power, that I have to be open to the opportunities to practice these principles in all my affairs, and so that I can get to carry the message. And I think that's all I have. If you all want to, can I stop? No, I can't stop. Thank you.
Okay, so we got like 5 minutes left, so we have questions. If anybody want to speak, can do a comment.